Hello and welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast which was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about whatever the fuck we feel like talking about. I am Milo Edwards. I am joined, as ever, by my co-hosts, Patrick Wyman and Phoebe Roy. How are we doing?
We're doing good.
I'm doing great. I'm fantastic.
I'm the birthday boy. I'm the Festa Giotto.
Yes.
This is...
The Festa Giotto. It feels something that like a homophobic slur the Pope would use.
It does sound like something you'd overhear at the College of Cardinals and not in a good way.
Yeah.
That's the brackets negative.
Yeah. Yeah,
what are the Cardinals but a bunch of little birthday boys? I mean, look at those outfits.
They're all wearing the little birthday boy crowns.
Mm.
We've discussed this before, but the lack of a Skims licensing deal with the Vatican is a real oversight in modern brand management. Mm. Like, there's just so much that could be done there. How do they have no undergarment partnership?
I genuinely don't get it. You know what else they should have over there at the Vatican? They should also have, like, you know those companies that make like custom branded stuff for kind of hen and stag do's. So like the bride has like the dressing gown, it says bride on the back, and then the bridesmaids have the bridesmaid one that all ends up in landfill. Those things, but for the Pope and the College of
Cardinals.
But dressing
gown that says Pope then like the other ones that say Cardinal.
Exactly. If I was Pope, the first thing I'd do is order just a bunch of monogrammed everything, just saying Pope.
Mm-hmm. Well, the closest they get to a stag do is the conclave, basically.
Yeah.
Correct.
I've already seen the pictures of them all like ripping cigs in the fucking Vatican courtyard and stuff, and I'm
it's less like a stag do. It's more like a school trip, the conclave. Like there's the troublemaker cardinals. They're sitting at the back of the coach. It's 10:30. They've started in all their sandwiches.
Yeah. You also have the bicurious cardinals. Yep. Also a feature of every boys' school trip.
Bicurious cardinals, what, like they're considering some heterosexual sex.
They put on their ruby red vestments. They put on their Skims. They're looking in the mirror and they're thinking, this is interesting.
So I had a friend in graduate school when I lived in Ireland who was Italian. Her name was Francesca. She was awesome. She was great. Her brother was a Monsignor who had been assigned to the Vatican and was like basically embarking on the Vatican career. And so I met this guy and she was telling me about her brother before I met him. He didn't speak English. He only spoke Italian. So we communicated through a mixture of Italian and Spanish and like maybe a little German thrown in there for good measure. I was in grad school. It very expected in grad school to have an interaction like this. But what I took from those conversations was that while, yes, there are a great many gay or interested in men cardinals, a lot of the clergy are just knee deep in women. I had not realized the extent to which there are just horny priests and monsignors and other church officials running around who are just having full-blown sexual liaisons with their parishioners. Like, this was unclear to me until I spoke to this gentleman and he made it very clear to me in several languages that I wasn't fluent in.
Well,
so just the more you know.
There you go.
The more you know.
So he said in what, Italian, that parishioner pussy goes crazy.
That, yes, in so many words. Yes.
That parishioner pussy.
That was, I mean, I was pretty drunk at the time, and so was he, and so was everybody. So my knowledge of these events, even leaving aside the fact that it was like 16 years ago, is pretty hazy.
You still remember it.
We did end that day with me getting a personalized blessing for my dying grandmother, which brought her some
that's
solace.
Nice.
Signed by the Nazi Pope.
Benedict. That's less good.
Less good, yeah, but you know what? You take what you can get. Whoever's sitting in the throne of St. Peter, you take what you can get.
I'm a Nazi Pope, but you know, a blessing's a blessing.
Particularly if it's a personalized blessing. That's like a cameo from the Pope.
Mm. Yeah, but you know what? Grandma loved it. She was not one to question authority.
Yeah.
which very, very typical greatest generation Irish Catholic, right? Yeah, there. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing with they're always like ripping on the Catholic, the insane like far right Catholic converts for this, particularly the American ones who are always like going on about like the woke soy pope or whatever. And it's like, you're Catholic. You think the Pope is infallible. You can't. Yeah. You're either Catholic or Protestant. You've got to pick a lane.
You can be a Catholic sedevacantist.
I don't fuck with the Opus Dei people. I don't mess with them. They've got a bit of a vibe, haven't they? So I spend a lot of time in Catholic circles because my kids go to a Catholic school and we are at least technically members of the parish. And so I'm kind of regularly around these folks.
I'm hip to the conclave.
And I would say compared to my childhood, the number of absolute freaks in the Catholic Church, like the proportion of them is much higher. Like Catholics when I was a kid, like, yeah, sure, you had a few people in the parish who were always really into it, you know, like these people did exist, but I would say they make up such a larger proportion now, and they're so much more vocal and they're so much weirder than was the case when I was young. Like there really are not, as far as I can tell, a lot of like cultural Catholics left in the United States, like people who grew up with the church and went to church and you know, maybe you get confirmed because that's the thing, and then you just kind of stop going as an adult.
Catholics.
That's just way less common than it used to be. Like the people who are left are the people who decided to stick through it through the scandals and the Nazi Pope are committed. They are committed to the bit.
They're Italian.
Well, if the Pope's Italian and he hates gay people, then yeah, they're on board.
They should have he should have really leaned into being the Nazi Pope, you know, like black vestments, you know, like stamping his decrees with a little swastika.
Yeah,
at that point you can't be fired from being
boy
Pope.
Of the Vatican. Like he's like the wrestling heel. Like he comes out and is like, "Boo! It's the Nazi Pope! Boo!
Pope Benedict coming down from the rafters with a baseball bat and like, a full mask.
Is that Ayatollah Khomeini's music? Pope.
Yeah." like Sting in 1998 in the WCW.
Exactly, yeah, like that.
That is
exactly,
yeah.
Okay. Like
well,
that.
I think we've figured out how to bring the papacy into at least the 20th century, if not the 21st.
Yeah. Patriarch Kirill coming at him with a steel chair.
That's
look.
Exactly.
We're just coming up with marketing ideas left, right, and center. Like if the Vatican's not on the blower to us by the end of this episode, then I don't even know what to say.
Hire us.
I mean. Bring us into the College of Cardinals. Like you telling me that we wouldn't have good things to say at the conclave?
I'm already in the College of Cardinals. I'm a diversity and inclusion hire.
That hasn't gotten rolled back yet.
Unfortunately, Carol from Vatican HR, she forced them to put me in there. Nobody's happy about it.
We met outside. We were vaping outside the Sistine Chapel. We met. We kikied, and now I'm in the College of Cardinals. Like I don't know how it happened either.
There you go.
Yeah,
I showed up. I had my
paperwork.
You guys
want to talk about Black Death?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so
Black Death. Black Death. My favorite Italian movie.
Well, all right. So first of all, I am the birthday boy. It is my birthday today. I am the little birthday boy. I am the festa giato. It is important that there is a word in Italian for birthday boy. For what I'm about to say next. Now, for a variety of reasons, it turns out that I watched this movie that we're about to discuss, The Black Death, in Italian, because the copy that Milo sent was in Italian. Allegedly, there was a way of turning it not into Italian, but unfortunately, I'm very beautiful and can therefore not be expected to mess around with changing languages, looking for subtitles, things of this nature. Also, it is my birthday, so unfortunately, if anyone does try to make fun of me for accidentally watching it in Italian, I will call the FBI. All right, we're 10 minutes in. You have got less than 2 minutes of making mock of me for accidentally watching it in Italian. And then unfortunately, any point after that, I will call the police.
Ciao ragazzi, parliamo a Il Morto Negro.
Uh-huh. Yep. Starring Giovanni Fagioli.
Yeah, that's right.
I just kept picturing you as one of those elderly Italian guys who goes to the construction sites to criticize the construction workers.
Oh, yeah.
When you said that you had watched this in Italian, my brain immediately went to, oh, Phoebe's training to be one of those guys. I'm training
by going to creepy monasteries and criticizing the monks. That's the first step on the route. Like they don't.
And they have to take it because they're
monks. They're
monks.
What are they going to do?
Especially find one of the silent ones and you can really go to town on them.
You can really riff on a silent monk because what's he going to do? I mean, obviously, in some areas, the three of us are uniquely skilled. I reckon that we could irritate a silent monk into talking.
After 40 minutes of your theories, I reckon you'd say something.
40 minutes is giving that monk way too much credit. I think that monk makes it, if it's all three of us, that monk makes it 9 minutes.
Yeah, 9 minutes maybe, of hearing about Vatican Times skims, I reckon.
We're examining the reliquary and just talking about the curves on the reliquary. And this guy's going to be done.
Hey,
he's
Pat,
out.
How far do you reckon you can throw this reliquary?
He wasn't technically a Nazi.
Oh,
okay?
So far. I could toss this reliquary over a motherfucking hill.
Hey, Pat,
that's how
much
I could
of the True Cross could you bench? Bet it's loads.
Oh,
bet the whole thing.
The whole thing. I could bench the whole cross.
You could do that as like a kind of Easter workout special.
Easter CrossFit wad. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, Jacked Jesus is one of my favorite American innovations.
Truly putting the cross in CrossFit.
That's it, absolutely, buddy, you nailed it. If you've ever been, and if you've ever spent much time in a CrossFit gym, you would know how accurate
that is.
I
nailed it, as did the Romans.
That's 100%. And as did the torturers among the villagers in the movie Black Death, which is what we're talking about today. We've now passed the 2 minute mark, Phoebe.
Very good. Yeah.
Our little festeggiato here has safely made it through the window.
Okay, so as it turns out, now, as far as I'm concerned, I can speak pretty good Italian, as far as I'm concerned. Or certainly as far as I'm concerned when I started watching this movie. Turns out I'm not correct about that. Okay. So I don't have that solid a handle on what happened in this film. I can give you a pretty good account of it visually. I can tell you what it looked like, and I also read the plot summary afterwards. But putting it together, that's going to be a little bit beyond me.
So I don't think that's actually a handicap here. And I'll tell you why. Because this movie, the plot is not especially relevant. It's a pretty basic, straightforward plot. Like there's nothing especially complicated happening. It's a really basic three act structure. The course of events is pretty straightforward and easy to explain. They are in the city, which is suffering from the plague. They go out into the forest where they encounter various bad things, and then they come to the village where they discover worse things, and are forced to confront the possibility of the supernatural and the pitfalls of their own faith. So that's literally the whole movie. It's not more complicated than that. What is interesting about this movie, I think, is the setting, the vibe. I think the visuals are pretty awesome. I think it's visually a really interesting movie. But before we kind of break that stuff down, should we talk a little bit about the Black Death and why it matters?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so this movie is set during what I assume is the first outbreak of the Black Death, which would put it somewhere around 1348 if we're in England. That's roughly when the plague reached the lovely shores of the British Isles. So it is, at a basic level, the Black Death is the most important thing that happens in the later Middle Ages. If we're looking at the period between about 1300 and 1500, there is nothing more essential to understanding why stuff happens the way it does than the Black Death. It's caused by a bacterium called Yersinia pestis, which has been around in human history for a very long time. Our oldest archaeological evidence of it goes back at least 4,500 years, and I think has actually even been pushed back further by some recent papers. So Yersinia pestis has been around a long time. It has recurred as a pandemic on multiple occasions in human history. The Justinianic plague, which broke out in the middle of the 6th century, was also Yersinia pestis. So kind of periodically, this disease, for a series of reasons that we can and in some cases can't reconstruct, spread, was extraordinarily lethal. This particular outbreak of it in the middle of the 14th century, the most famous one, kills about half the population of Europe.
Mm.
So if we want to understand this as a thing and understand why people lost their fucking minds, which they did, they really did. The plague drove people nuts. That's one of the things I like about this movie is it shows people being driven to absolute extremes by their lack of understanding of why these things are happening around them. And that's absolutely accurate. If half the people you knew were just dead in a week, it would fuck with your mind. And that is very much what happens in the middle of the 14th century is there is a society-wide freak out that goes along with all of this mass death that rewrites a lot of social norms. It fundamentally changes the economies of peasant societies in Western Europe around this time. A lot of what we take for granted about the transition to a more modern, like capitalistic, if you want to call it that, way of doing economies comes out of the demographic consequences of the Black Death. This isn't to say it's a good thing, but this is the kind of a necessary precondition for labor-saving innovations, for an emphasis on land as opposed to labor, being willing to take risks with economic productivity, moving away from pure subsistence in a lot of places. This is all predicated on the Black Death. So it's an enormously important event for us to make sense of this period, but even leaving aside those longer term outcomes, it was also just an insane thing to live through, and people did live through it, and it did irrevocably alter them in some really fucked up ways. So to the extent that this movie has something interesting to say about the 14th century, I think it's that. I think that it really nails just how deranged it made the overall mood of the period. And we can see, and even if the responses that we see in the movie, and there are things that we see in the movie that are not what I would call historically accurate or reflective of the time period, I think the overall frame of people losing their shit makes a ton of sense. And I think that's a really valuable contribution here.
Yeah. Because obviously this is a thing where, especially in the UK, like you learn about this in school, but you learn about it when you're so young that I feel like my knowledge of it is like very like folklore-y at this point, where I can't really remember a lot of like the hard facts. I mean, like, because obviously it was spread by rats, but actually by fleas, right? Fleas on rats, they think.
Yeah. So this is one of the areas where the scholarship has changed in recent years. I tend to think that human to human transmission played a much larger role in the movement of the Black Death than was traditionally assumed. Mm-hmm. So when we really break it down, the Yersinia pestis, the actual symptoms that it causes can broadly be broken down into two categories that are relevant. There's a bubonic plague, which is where you get the swellings, the buboes, the really characteristic things that we see in this movie, the lumps on the neck, under the armpits, in the groin would be another characteristic place to have them. That's the dominant form of it. But there is also pneumonic plague. That's where the Yersinia pestis gets down into your lungs. It gets into your bloodstream. It kills you oftentimes within hours of contracting it. So it's a much more rapid kind of infection. And also because you're coughing up blood and other fluids, it's much more transmissible person to person. And when we dig into plague accounts, it's easy to focus on the bubonic aspects of it, but there's also what appears to be pneumonic plague happening. So if we want to understand why it's lethal and why it's so lethal and how it's able to travel so far so fast, I think you have to give more emphasis to the mnemonic side of it than would have been the case a couple of decades ago. And if you're if you think pneumonic plague mattered a lot more, then you don't have to focus as much on rats, fleas as a vector of transmission. So yes, rats and fleas do matter a lot, but plague also shows up in places where there's no archaeological evidence of rats from this period. Fleas are perfectly capable of moving without rats. Fleas are a major vector of transmission, but people are also giving this disease to each other. We have a surprising amount of archaeological evidence of the Black Death from this period. There have been in recent years excavations of a whole bunch of plague pits. So just mass graves of bodies that were dumped in pretty hastily around this time. In a lot of cases, there's still surviving plague DNA in those pits that's been extracted and sequenced. So we even know what the bacterium looked like at this specific moment in time. We can track its evolution over the course of these pandemics. See how the bacterium itself changed. We know a lot about the Black Death now. I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions about how and why it spread at precisely that moment. There's a lot of scholarship out there that's debating that, and I'm not convinced enough by any of it to come down on a side. But that's pretty up in the air, like how long this was happening in East and Central Asia before it started to spread west. Was the plague active in China during this period? There's some good evidence to suggest that, yes, it was active decades before it spread westward in China. There's probably something about environmental conditions at this point in time that may have expanded the range of the prairie dogs, like small rodents that were the natural zoonotic reservoir for the plague bacterium. There's all sorts of stuff like that. I don't think it's really essential. What matters is it happened. It was really, really, really bad. And it forever altered kind of the fabric of Western European society, economy, politics, not as much, but economy and society for sure. Views of death, absolutely. I can't think of another way to say it other than plague is really, really, really goddamn important. It is the most essential thing to grasp about this period of time.
And that's why the creators of the movie Black Death decided to give it such an intelligent and sensitive treatment.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Incredibly well-written stuff. I'm just thinking on the Wikipedia now. One of the writers is uncredited, which I always think is a good sign when someone's like, you know what, actually, don't put my name on this.
Yeah, you paid me $300,000 to punch up the script, and I don't want anybody to know that I worked on it.
Yeah, that's the uncredited writer is the it's the director.
Oh,
yeah, Christopher Smith. He did Creep, Severance, Triangle, and Black Death. But the main writer was Dario Poloni. I'm now starting to understand why this may have been in Italian.
Right.
Yeah. No figures on budget.
But I can't imagine it was high.
Box office of $272,000. Woof.
Yep. Nice. Not good, is it? Not good. Probably didn't make back the principal on that one.
No, it would be really hard to make a feature length film for less than that.
Yeah. The dirt budget alone for this movie is substantially higher.
Well, they needed a budget to kill off Sean Bean. You know, he's not very keen on being killed off.
He does just fucking die in everything, man. A truly remarkable run of dying in much the same role over and over again.
And he's always dying in new and inventive ways. In this one, he gets pulled apart by horses like he's a fucking victim of Genghis Khan.
Does.
Pretty fucking cool. Not a bad way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually a pretty bad way to go.
I think that looks like a pretty bad way to go personally. Because, like, if nothing else, it's very undignified. For your fate to be in the hands or the hooves of a horse.
The hooves. Because do you reckon it feels really good for the first few seconds?
That's right. Oh no, wait, hang on, no. Oh.
Yeah, let's just stop there.
too far.
Oh no. Yeah. Oh yeah. Ow.
Yeah. No, it does. I bet it feels amazing for just a short period of time. No, I would rather go that way than bubonic plague though.
Interesting.
Oh, okay.
I would much rather go pulled apart by horses than bubonic plague. No question in my mind.
Honestly, I'm just now thinking about like someone recommending their new physio. You go in and it's like a horse wearing one of those like lab coats and you're being like, oh, no, 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 no. No, no, no.
It's that French horse that goes to visit the dying.
I'm working hard on a horse's chiropractor joke right now, and there's a lot that we could do with that. But I feel like this may not be the time.
Chiropractor.
Yeah, or euthanasia. What about that?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, this is the thing. I think that, like, I like horses. I'm pro horse. This is not a criticism of the horse as a cohort. But you have to admit that historically horses have got, they've got a really, really good PR team working harder than the devil, because to me, horse is an inherently comical animal. And for some reason, they've managed to cement themselves in the collective psyche as a very noble and dignified animal. But I think they're silly. I think they're daft. I think they're dafties. I think they're
They're scared of cyclists. And no one's scared of cyclists.
I think they're big dafties. And I think being executed by a horse It's just a little bit embarrassing. Like, you imagine, like, the horse is like chatting afterwards and being like, "What did you do today? I ran around a field. What did you do today? I don't know. I had some oats. I just imagine how good it must feel to be a horse chowing down on its oats from a feed bag. Just like whenever you're like, you know what, I'm a bit peckish. You don't even have to move. You're just like, it's there in your nose bag. And then another horse is like, oh yeah, I executed Sean Bean. He did what? Is anyone listening? Everyone listening to Greg? He reckons he executed Sean Bean. that's what Greg reckons. And Greg is like the liar horse that everyone knows. Like, I did execute him. Yeah.
Well, in conjunction with another horse. You can't really do a solo.
Let's not write Greg off so fast.
Pantomime horse, just like missing the second half, being like, you know what, we can't do any executions today because I'm missing my flanks.
Being pulled apart by a pantomime horse,
like a horse miming pulling someone apart.
Yeah.
Like two men in a horse costume.
Yeah. Oh yeah, because you don't know, because it's a pantomime something different. In America. Pat, are you familiar with the British pantomime?
Phoebe, I can honestly say that I'm not.
Oh, boy. Okay, so.
Oh, boy.
Once a year at Christmas, we, the British, like to participate in an arcane winter wassailing ritual. And it involves going to see the most mental version of a staged fairy story starring C-list people off the telly. C-list might be generous, like M-list.
Young jobbing actors.
M-list people off the telly. And there are a series of standard stories that make it into the pantomime era. There's a really famous like Cinderella, there's a Sleeping Beauty, there's Babes in the Wood, etc. And there is...
I saw one with Alexandra Burke and Joe Pasquale
Exactly.
Yeah.
It suddenly occurs to me, you probably don't know who either of those are.
Joe Pasquale sounds familiar enough that I should know who that is.
Joe Pasquale.
Oh, I know who Joe Pasquale is.
Do you know who Alexandra Burke is? Did she win the X Factor, or was she just an X Factor contestant?
She was certainly a finalist. I think she might have won it,
I don't know what that is.
Oh, the X Factor is like American Idol, but the UK version. Yeah.
I'll take your... I've never watched a single minute of any of those shows.
She's a singer, basically. But she's washed up.
Yeah.
She is a bit washed up, but also... what was it that Alexandra Burke claimed that she invented?
Oh, the expression, the elephant in the room.
She said she invented the expression, the elephant in the room.
I'm a fan already.
Popularized it.
I, ironically, whenever Alexandra Burke comes up, that is the elephant in the room.
Yeah, so a British pantomime, you go, like, they're on, like, between Christmas and New Year, and you go as a family.
And before Christmas,
yeah,
also.
Yeah, before Christmas as well. And there's, like, a kind of set, like they're honestly, they're not so dissimilar to a Roman comedy. There's, like, a series of kind of, like, set conventions.
A lot of cross-dressing.
The audience is expected to participate.
Booing, hissing, cheering, etc.
Like if you see like the
so it's like a mystery
kind
play.
Of. If you see the villain, you're supposed to say he's behind you, and they go like what, where, and then the villain hides. Or there's the bit where the villain says something and the audience says, oh, no, you're not. And the villain says, oh, yes, I am. And there is a pantomime dame who's like, I think, like Widow Twanky, that kind of, who is played by another M-list actor off the telly. Normally, I don't know, like Christopher Biggins, someone like that. How do I explain who Christopher Biggins is?
I feel like Biggins is a bit too famous, actually.
I can tell you, we don't need to delve any deeper into the details of this. What I can tell you is that this is a hell of a pitch and I will not ever be attending one.
Yeah.
This is,
anyway,
so
they quite often have a horse in them, two men in a horse costume.
And that's okay.
One front legs, one back legs.
And that's a pantomime horse. I don't know if this is the case anymore, but routinely this is the case when I was a child, oddly, it would be the most famous of all of the actors involved who would be in the horse.
Would be the horse.
Which is probably quite a good way of claiming that.
Yeah, well, it was John McCririck that one year.
Oh, yeah, it was, wasn't it? Again, how do you explain John McCririck to an American? I can't.
This is such a wonderfully revealing look into aspects of your lovely culture.
Yeah.
Look, one year,
yeah, I'm not
one
even
going
to explain
Meryl
to you
Streep
who John McCririck is,
horse.
But I'm going to send you a picture of him.
Yeah.
Because you just need
Meryl Streep.
Yeah, Meryl Streep was in that horse. And you know what? She brought the same dedication to her craft, to that role that she brings to every role. She played both parts of the horse.
So It's Complicated is one of my favorite movies. I love Meryl Streep. Huge Meryl Streep fan. Huge Streep head.
Big Streep head.
Oh, my God. Okay, this makes sense. So he's okay. All right. Okay. The vibe is becoming much clearer to me after you sent me this picture, Milo.
The CNN picture for the headline, John McCririck, horse racing pundit, dead at 79, has got to be one of the most insane obituary. He's smoking a cigar that's half ash. He's got his lamb chop sideburn things. He's got his glasses on a chain. He's wearing the kind of hat that the Witchfinder General used to wear. He's got a fucking a Texas bow tie on, and he appears to be wearing a dressing gown.
He reminds me a lot of my great uncle Joe, who used to take me to the off track betting place around the corner from his apartment. And who constantly did smoke very cheap, very large cigars.
Amazing.
That was his vibe.
He also drank
malt liquor, but Ooh. Not in the big 40-ounce containers. He would buy like small containers of malt liquor. He's the only person I've ever known who bought like small containers of malt liquor. Very odd.
Oh,
very odd,
like man. The half bottle, the 250 mil. Yeah.
Yeah. Why? What's the purpose of a container of malt liquor that small? I ain't drinking it for the taste. It's not an aperitif.
It's a shot.
Yeah. Anyway, leaving aside my great uncle Joe, dearly departed these past 30 something years.
Sue, it's an undignified way for Giovanni de Fagioli to go, for sure. What I always wonder is not so much, because we talked about this a bit last week, because he's in Troy and of course does not die because he plays Odysseus, and he did have this copy of the Odyssey to shore him up against any potential death scenes. Like, look, no, says right here.
I got a sequel
right here, and he's not meant to be a ghost. What I always wonder, if you're Sean Bean, is whether or not he tries to negotiate a hairbrush at the start of filming. Fine, fair enough, kill me off, I don't care, whatever, but can I at least look a little bit less scruffy, just a bit less straggly.
So I think that's an important part of his charm, because when they were filming Lord of the Rings, very famously, he's averse to helicopters. He will not ride in a helicopter. So when they were filming the scene in the Fellowship of the Ring where they're going over the mountain pass, right, where they're like knee deep in snow, he would not take the helicopter up to the shooting site. So he would leave before dawn where they were staying, and he would climb the mountain in his costume to arrive at the filming site. So they would be, Peter Jackson has given interviews where he talks about this, of them, you know, they leave the campsite at a normal time in the helicopter to go up to the place where they're shooting. And as they're flying over, they just see Sean Bean down below wearing his full costume, climbing the mountain by himself. Like, that's, so I don't know what that means as far as hairbrush norms would go, but I think he's probably chill. I think he's probably okay with it.
My line, I'm going to need you to cut this out, but I'm going to tell you just a really, really brief, really cute story about Sean Bean. But Milo.
Oh, this is, I thought you might bring this up. This is a good one.
Yeah, yeah, but I don't think Pat's heard it.
I cannot tell you how much joy this has brought me, knowing that Sean Bean doesn't suck.
He's really nice.
Because, especially because he played Richard Sharpe in those TV adaptations, loved the Sharpe books. I've read every one of the Sharpe books many times.
Somehow I'm not shocked by this revelation.
That I'm a Bernard Cornwell head. Yeah, I suppose that was, you probably could have called that one out. God damn it. I'm so glad. He just seems like a good dude, and I kind of want to give him a hug. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. He seems like a guy who'd give a good hug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. Anyway. Yeah,
like, maybe not Viggo Mortensen hug, but a good one. Or Pedro Pascal hug. I feel like that man would give an excellent hug also.
Hmm.
As much as I would love to discuss this further. Yeah. Which
famous non-piece of shit actors would give a good hug?
There are just so few of them. That's the problem.
Yeah. It's a short list.
That's very true.
So I would like to talk a little bit about the various torture techniques used.
Yeah, please.
In this movie.
Do you want to explain like how we get to the point where torture scenes happen? Like just like kind of a sort of a brief précis of the plot for those who are not followers of Dante and therefore watched it in English. If you could just...
For those who have not watched
Followers of Dante sounds like the way that you would call a lesbian like a friend of Ellen.
A friend of Ellen.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's someone who's like not Italian, but you know, they have dabbled.
Yeah, they've dabbled a little bit. Just a little bit in the Florentine dialect.
They've eaten some pasta al dente. They've yelled at somebody for having a cappuccino past 9 o'clock.
One of those. Yeah. So how do we end up with torture? Well, the basic plot of the movie is that there is a village out in the middle of a swamp that is somehow not affected by the plague. And the Sean Bean and his merry band of miscreants have been ordered by the bishop to go investigate. And so they pick up Eddie Redmayne, the monk, as a guide. Eddie Redmayne only wants to go because he wants to meet his lady friend, Averill, in the terrifying woods where she has fled the city to go. When they get into the woods, they meet a less merry band of miscreants who fight them. And we are led to believe that this merry band of miscreants has made off with or killed Eddie Redmayne's lady friend, whose name is Averill. Great name. Then they find the village. They're welcomed to the village. They eat, they drink, they make merry. And then they're kind of drugged, put in a prison, and
everyone like kind of loses their suspicions apart from Sean Bean, who's like, no, this is it seems. Yeah, only the bishop's envoy wears this cross. They sent a previous 4 men, none returned, and look, she's wearing it there.
Yeah. In fairness, he wasn't
Sean
wrong.
Sean Bean's seen Midsommar, and he knows that if there's a kind of like superficially friendly friendly kind of folk village in the middle of nowhere, you probably should sleep with one eye open.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. The plot of Midsommar is like so something that would happen to Riley.
You could probably persuade him that, like, what's that horrible thing that happens in Midsommar, which obviously I haven't seen because, you know.
Well, when they set him alight inside a bear.
No, it's a particular.
Oh, the bit where the old people have to jump off the cliff and kill themselves.
It's a particular thing. It's a particular kind of dismemberment technique. It's called, like, the eagle or something.
Oh, the blood eagle, where you pull the ribs and the lungs out the back, right? Yeah.
Isn't that in Midsommar?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Oh. The two, like, gore bits that I remember are the bits where people have to jump off the cliff onto this rock to kill themselves, and the bit where they set him alight they got a bear, yeah, and they put him inside the bear carcass and then they set fire to him.
Again, a very horrible and also very undignified way to go.
It is pretty undignified. Yeah, you're like a sort of macabre Paddington.
Yeah.
Offering up a marmalade sandwich to the pagan gods.
You guys have completely broken me.
Cat's head in hand.
I'm dead. I'm done with. I got nothing.
Winnie
offering
the pagan.
A marmalade sandwich? A macabre Paddington? What the fuck is happening here? I feel compelled.
I mean, like, it's more
just
like a macabre sooty and sweep. Because
and little cousin Scampy
there's
too.
There's the hand puppet element.
God damn it.
Yeah. Florence Pugh as little cousin Scampy.
Look, you don't know what Sooty and Sweep are saying. They could be saying something really, really horrible.
We have to appease the ancient gods. Exactly. For a good harvest.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to appease the ancient gods by rejecting God. They are going to make their village safe. Really, of course, as is revealed in the later parts of the movie, the only reason why the village has not been struck by the plague is because it's isolated. It's not because of human sacrifice. It's not because of rejecting God or anything like that. The very clever wise woman of the village, played by Game of Thrones' own Carice Van Houten, looking in prime form here, by the way, prime Carice Van Houten. She's like, they need to believe in something. They need proof of miracles. And so basically she is providing them with a belief system to use to justify their kind of being out of the way, being out of the mainstream, being kept safe from these things, that they're creating a kind of an anti-Christianity in order to get people to buy into this. That is the idea. Now, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in here that does reflect in perhaps not intentional ways on the 14th century. One of the big ones is that we don't popular religion, like what peasants were out there doing in their villages and calling Christianity, did not necessarily have a lot to do with what a bishop or a bunch of monks sitting in their cathedrals and monasteries thought Christianity was. Folk religion in the Middle Ages looked a lot different. Folk Christianity looked a lot different. There were all sorts of mixtures of beliefs out there. And this was, in fairness to the movie's overall frame, something that religious authorities became increasingly concerned with over the course of the Middle Ages. Once everybody was kind of nominally Christian, we're like, okay, we're all Christian. And you've got parish priests assigned to all of these different places who may or may not be doing their jobs. Probably not. Then everybody, at least theoretically, kind of fell under the purview of ecclesiastical authority. Now, the ability of those authorities to actually dictate how people practiced their religion and especially what they believed was pretty limited. It's a real mistake to think of the medieval church as a comprehensive tool of social control, because it didn't have that capacity. They simply didn't. the idea that the medieval church had inquisitors running around tracking down everybody who expressed a contrary thought is ridiculous. It bears no resemblance to historical reality. The medieval church was a big tent, and it had to be. It was full of beliefs that in certain settings could get you labeled as heretical, and yet in other places and other contexts were completely normal to have. It's very much in the eye of the beholder, which I think is kind of an interesting thing about this movie, is that we are looking at this from the eye of a particular set of beholders, right? Where it's trying to make us see what they see and understand why they see this as a threat. We're invited to try to think about it from that perspective as an internally coherent thing, because for them, this was internally coherent, right? Like I do like that they kind of drop us into this very odd world with a lot of very odd things happening, and they don't try to over-explain it. They're just like, off you go, make sense of these things.
Yeah. And that's sort of an immersive element to like things that you perhaps don't think about when you think about the Middle Ages, if you're not a historian, like the way that, you know, the envoy of the bishop has been tasked with his band of armed men to go and find this village and see what's going on there. But like, all they really have to go on is sort of rumor. And also like, they have to find a guy who knows where it is, because there's no other way of getting there. Like there's not like a map or a road or like a, so they're going to like nearby towns and being like, anyone know where this is?
This is one of the things I find really interesting about the Middle Ages, is that you can be geographically very close to centers of power, centers of economic activity, cultural centers, and yet live in an entirely different world. This is true of all periods of history, but I think it's especially striking with the Middle Ages, because you have bishops and monasteries and castles, and these things all tend to kind of cluster in particular places. And then you just have huge swaths of the countryside where the peasants are off doing their own thing. And in a lot of cases, we don't really know what was happening there because we don't have sources for it. That these places just kind of were outside the viewpoint of authorities who left behind written records. So there are whole generations of medieval peasants who lived their lives entirely unrecorded by any text, who were practicing their own beliefs, who were living, if not autonomously, at least with only intermittent contact with church authorities, with secular authorities. And that's something I think is really interesting in this movie, when we get to the village and the village headman is like perfectly confident, right? Like, this is his place. He lives there. He's in charge. And that this freaks out the bishop's guys. Like, the idea of a peasant being so kind of confident and in charge is a little off-putting to our friend Ulrich, the bishop's man. It's like hard for him to figure out what to do with it. But I think that's an interesting reflection of an actual medieval reality.
That is interesting. Because like any popular culture about the medieval period, and when I say the medieval period, like the several hundred years that this encapsulates, because decades and centuries are sort of meaningless when you are doing popular culture, as we discussed last week when we were talking about Troy. Mm-hmm. What is always the case is that if you come across, there are two types of remote, out of the way village in anything about the medieval period, or kind of a pretendo medieval period. So if it's like really like idyllic and beautiful and everyone is like chill and there are like chickens and goats and stuff, you know that some kind of fuckhead is gonna come through there and do something awful. If it's a slightly bigger village and everyone seems very welcoming, and there's maybe a guy in a waistcoat who's just there and he's just around, then you know that something pretty awful is going to happen to whoever it is that rides through. Those are the two options. Yeah. For
an M. Night Shyamalan type village.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly the vibe. You know what? I would have loved it if that had been the reveal at the end of the Black Death. At the end of Black Death, they'd just been like, guess what?
Warning, spoilers for M. Night Shyamalan's The Village.
Everyone in it's got the plague. That's the twist.
Pat's explainer about, you know, the sort of like the urban rural divide in medieval Europe was making me think about what Russia is like now. And I remember once we were talking about like I was hanging out with this woman I worked with on the TV. She was a comedian. She was from like proper like shithole, like tiny town in like rural Russia, like in the Urals. And it was in a place, Orenburgskaya Oblast. So it's like in the kind of in the county of Orenburg. And she's like, where I'm from, like people didn't used to leave the village. And then she's like, they used to take the piss out of people for going to Orenburg, which is like a regional town. They're like, you know, she was like, people used to come back from Orenburg and they'd be like, whoa, Gorodskoy, like, whoa, city boy, like what? And then she was like, one time a guy from Moscow visited where I was from just on like a business trip or something, and they wrote about it in the newspaper. They put a picture of him. And she was like, basically, if you went there, they would lose their fucking mind.
So, like, this is closer to the norm for the vast majority of human history than the idea of just being able to go to a city and then go back to the place. Like, our portrait of so many past ages is dependent on atypical examples and atypical survivals. That, like, a cathedral was not a normal thing for a medieval person to hang out at, right? No. Like, a castle was not a normal thing for a peasant to go be like, I'm going to the castle today. In fact, the peasant would be like, I'm staying away from the castle because that's where they'll make me do stuff I don't want to do.
Yeah.
So when we actually think about the lived reality of these periods of the past, it's much more likely to be shit poor village in the middle of nowhere with no meaningful contact with the broader streams of culture and religion and politics than it is, I'm living in the thing, and there's the king. We saw the king today, and oh, that's the bishop. Like, no, they never saw these people. This was not their experience of the world.
Yeah, they were coming up with their own slang.
Yeah, the village was the social unit for a tremendous period of time. And when we actually have evidence of what was happening in the village, we can see this really beautifully interconnected, fascinating social world of a kind that doesn't really exist anymore, where like villages in the Middle Ages, everybody owed everybody money. They were all married to each other. They all knew each other. They'd all grown up with each other. It was an economic unit. It was a social unit. It was a religious unit. It was also a political unit that if, you know, you had to provide some soldiers for something, that was going to be assessed on the basis usually of the village. And your village headman, our friend Hob, whom we meet here, that guy actually has a lot of authority to determine how things are run in the village. And if it's subject to a lord, the village headman is going to be the one who works with the bailiff to provide taxes or labor services or whatever. So I do love that this movie takes us into a village, which is the basic social unit of the Middle Ages, filled with the actual kind of people who mostly inhabited the Middle Ages.
Yeah, waistcoat wearers.
I mean, you really do want to see the admin side of grim torture methods, which, that's what I've always thought was like missing from your kind of average sort of torture porn movie. You're just like, you know what? I wanna see the forms.
So this was a thing. This was an actual thing. To the extent that we know anything about medieval heresy, it comes down to us through the records of the people who were doing the interrogation and the torturing. The most famous accounts of heretics and heresy as a phenomenon in the Middle Ages come from the Languedoc. They come from the south of France. They come from a series of purges that were launched in the 13th century, mostly in the 13th century. And our reconstruction of what these people who are labeled heretics thought, believed, the ways they acted, is entirely dependent on the outsider's view of these inquisitors and the notes that they took as they were interrogating people and writing them up. So we don't really know if medieval heresy was actually even a thing. We don't know what it was like, because the only people who wrote about it were people who were writing about it from a hostile outsider's perspective, who had their own ideas of what religion was supposed to be and how it was supposed to be organized. We don't know. As wild as that is, and that's also true of medieval popular religion. It's not like we don't know anything. We know some stuff. We have some evidence. But like the actual world of thought and religious belief that most medieval peasants inhabited is essentially gone to us. It is essentially closed off.
That's really interesting.
So,
Can I ask a question about the Black Death before you start talking about torture methods, which I know you want to?
I would love, I'm so, like, really get, excited
like,
about
like,
this.
Going
yes.
into like, going into Cat's letterbox and like, just like every single, like, kind of particularly kind of horrible, like, horrible horror film, just like 2 stars, not enough bureaucracy. I would like to see how they're squaring this with the council. And the question about the Black Death was, when I was at school, when we learned about the Black Death, like Milo, I sort of remember it as being sort of like at least partly folkloric, or certainly not necessarily folkloric, but certainly kind of, we had no context. We had nothing to put it in. It was just, this was just a subject that we learned at school, and we had nothing. And like, there was, because you don't, when you learn history at school, you don't learn any kind of like contextual information. You just learn that something happened in this year, and then you kind of do a kind of this huge jump, and it sort of makes you think.
Yeah, you learn vibes. You learn like the magic school bus
yeah,
version.
Like nothing happened between 1350 and 1480. That cannot be right, but okay, fine.
More like nothing happened between 1350 and about 1550.
Yeah, you jump straight from the Black Death to the dissolution of the monasteries. Maybe you get a little bit of the Wars of the Roses in there. Maybe you get the Princes in the Tower.
There was a little sprinkle of roses when I was at school, because they wanted to get us to draw them roses in order to
Peasants' Revolt, Queen Victoria, Hitler, Bosch. History, isn't it?
Pretty much. We had
bit of Romans, maybe.
Oh, we had some Thomas Becket. But then our history teacher went rogue and started teaching us a bunch of stuff she wasn't supposed to teach us. So that was interesting, which I didn't know until many years later that she had done. But
was it like her own made up history?
No. She taught this like kind of partially. Now I understand to be partially self devised module called like the Crimes of the British Empire, and I did not know that this was not being taught under normal rules.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not gonna get through any kind of British curriculum.
But like, literally, this was until I was an adult, and there'd been some controversy over whether or not the British Empire should be taught as a kind of net good or a net bad, or if it's being kind of, you know, glossed over when it's being taught both at kind of school level and later on at kind of undergraduate level as well. And I remember the discourse about it with people saying like, if you go to like a school in Britain, you have no idea about any of this stuff unless you happen to come from an immigrant background whose family were affected by it, and therefore you know about it as a kind of almost like a kind of oral history thing. If you go to a British school, as far as you're concerned, yeah, they're like, you know, there was a British Empire, something to do with tea, I guess a railway or two, but other than that,
trains.
Sounds fine, sounds relatively chill, sounds relatively kind of, oh, and we taught the First Nations people how to make bread, like a bit like that, you know. And I'd never have known about it. And I was like, yeah, but like, you do know about it because like, you know, you get taught like the famine of Calcutta, and you get taught like the Mau Mau massacre and stuff, right? And they were like, what? And I said, yeah. It's like, I don't know, like before you start GCSE and like when you're like in like year seven, year eight. And it turns out that this is not the case. And
yeah, no, you don't get taught that.
No. And because we what must have happened, I realize now, is that we went through the kind of the curriculum that she was meant to teach us. It's like, well, I've got some time left, so I'm going to teach you some other stuff, and that's what she went with. But she had like books and stuff. Like, she didn't like kind of pass out like kind of slightly kind of, oh, is this okay, kind of sort of, you know, home mimeographed kind of handouts or anything. Yeah. She had textbooks.
Bringing in the TV and sticking on Iranian press TV. You're like, is this on the curriculum?
Oh,
like,
are we?
George Galloway pointing at you through the screen.
Oh God, no.
I didn't know Juche thought was going to be part of this year's.
I want to be extremely clear to my old history teacher. She about as far removed as Galloway from Galloway as it is possible to be. She was a very nice woman. What I remember coming up in those classes was that there was an area of Europe. I think it was a bit of Poland that, for some reason, the Black Death didn't touch, because we had this map on the wall of like the kind of the most heavily affected areas, and then there's this weird kind of white bit, and I think it was like, I feel like it was in Warsaw.
Yeah. So that has it, my understanding, and this could be wrong, is that more recent research has filled those gaps and pointed out that those places did not actually escape. It's just that our sources for understanding the impact of the plague in those places were not very good. And our ability to understand kind of the chronology of plague outbreaks and the severity of them is really heavily dependent on what source material is available to us. So there are places where we can track it in extraordinary detail. So Florence is a good example of this, because we have surveys before and after showing that give us a sense for the population drop. But again, even though this is only 700 years ago, and a lot of the time on this show, we're dealing with stuff that happened a couple thousand years ago. The Middle Ages, it's not like we have reams and reams and reams of records from everywhere on the map in the Middle Ages. We have our sources tend to be very highly concentrated in particular places in particular times. And so trying to figure out what did the Black Death do in the countryside of the Low Countries is not necessarily an easy question to answer. Figuring out what happened between 1346 and 1351 in one area of Poland, well, if you don't have archives and you don't have narrative texts to work with for that particular area, the answer is you don't know. And so for a lot of time, for a long time, people figured that if there weren't explicit active reports telling us that the Black Death was happening in these places, then they must have escaped. That's no longer the assumption. The assumption now is more like, well, do we have anything that would tell us what was actually happening here at this place and time? So I would say that's kind of the genesis of that. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Y'all want to talk about torture?
Sure.
Let's do it.
Okay. So this is not a pro torture statement by any stretch of the imagination. But as shocking as some of the stuff that they do in this movie is, I think it's really important to remember that violence was very much a part of people's lived experience in the Middle Ages in a way that it is not for most people today. So and especially what we would call exemplary violence was really common, and it was especially meted out by higher powers to lower status people. So one of the things that's kind of interesting about this movie is that it is the lower status people, the peasants, who are doing the exemplary violence to the representatives of higher authorities. It's an interesting inversion of the reality, which was that it was authorities doing this stuff mostly to peasants. So in the aftermath of every major peasants' rebellion in Western Europe during the Middle Ages, you read just horrific accounts of things that nobles and soldiers did to the rebels. After the 1381 Peasants' Rebellion in England, for example, they would hamstring people. They would intentionally cut their hamstrings. They would chop them in half with dull blades and leave them out in public, leaving body parts to rot. This is a genuine facet of medieval society. This idea of doing violence in public, making an example of people, and especially as an example to be made of people lower down the social spectrum about what happens when you violate those hierarchies. That is a really quintessential part of how and why the Middle Ages functioned as they did. That violence is not just torture porn. It served a purpose. They knew what that purpose was, and they deployed it.
And horses, despite their effective PR rebrand, were complicit in that. So next time you see a horse,
the whole pulling people apart with horses thing really happened. They did that. The French nobles did that after the Jacquerie, the rebellion that happens in the late 1350s in France. They burned people alive. They like a lot of really, really, really horrible stuff.
It's difficult torturing people when you're French, because a lot of the tortures that you're doing are sort of inherently delicious to you. You know, you're watching a horse, you know, you're watching someone get burned alive. You're like, I could eat that.
Yeah. You know, yeah, it's
maybe,
just
maybe
like
we
duck.
Throw some of the horse on there and
hey, look, a horse is a delicious meal.
Yeah.
Let no one tell you otherwise. People been eating horses for 30,000 years. Always good. Always hits.
Yeah. See how they like it.
I don't think the horses eat them. That's part.
That's skill issue. Skill issue, Phoebe.
Yeah. We're going to pull this horse apart and then eat it.
Yep.
How many guys would it take to pull a horse apart?
Oh my God.
That has to be a significantly criminal horse, though.
I do think pretty regularly about how fucking funny the first attempts to ride a horse were.
Oh, like, God, yeah.
Imagine standing around with your boys somewhere out on the Eurasian steppe 5,500 years ago, and one of you is drunk on what I assume is fermented mare's milk, and is just like, you know, I'm going to see if I can ride that motherfucker.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean, Og? You're going to ride the horse?
What's riding?
We're gonna need to go. Yeah, like this is.
We speak Proto-Indo-European. We don't know what that is.
Yeah, riding. We don't even have a word for that. We haven't invented it yet. Yeah. That's like, I do think about that with some regularity, and it always makes me laugh. Like, there's no way that that wasn't fucking hilarious.
Yeah, the ancestors of what we can only assume to be modern day Russians and Canadians were stood around.
Why do I imagine the Proto-Indo-Europeans having an Alberta accent?
Yeah.
Hey there, buddy.
Hey, you're gonna write that, okay, bud? Fuck yeah.
I'm Og. Welcome, yeah,
immediately
jackass.
Legalized drink horse riding.
Yeah, the Proto-Indo-Europeans just sounded like the cast of Letterkenny. Is my understanding.
Exactly.
So
yeah, basically they round up our boys. They try and make them renounce God. One of them agrees to do it, and then they kill him anyway. They kill Sean Bean by pulling him apart with horses.
And because this is the thing. If that's happening, that those horses are full and active participants. You can't get a horse to pull someone apart unless they really want to.
Yeah, and they should face revolutionary justice. But, you know, Sean Bean to the end is like, I won't renounce God.
I'll be honest, if I was a kind of soldier of fortune, being told that I should go to a remote village run by a guy in a waistcoat, and I had to go with Sean Bean, I'd be like, are you fucking kidding me? Have you not seen any of his films? I'm not going anywhere with him.
Yeah. Can you not send me with, like, Steven Seagal or someone who miraculously never gets killed?
Yeah, like... Mm-hmm. Can you not?
We got an investigative.
Can you not send me with someone with a little bit more plot armor, please? All he's got is a straggly hair.
That's gonna be really concerning. Like, that's okay. First of all, that's awfully harsh. As a man with a gently receding hairline, I think Sean Bean's hair looks great, and I'm quite jealous of what that man's got going on. So I won't hear any Sean Bean hair slander here, Phoebe.
He can certainly
that lovely man. You're talking that way about that lovely man who hung out with you while your mom. Like, this is just unacceptable. No. So, what did you guys think of this? Because we haven't really talked about what do we think of this movie? Is this worth watching?
I didn't understand what was happening.
Well, that was the Italian. We swore.
Different star rating for watching this movie in Italian, for sure, which really, really adds a layer of confusion, which was unnecessary.
Due astra. I'm not a big film violence fan. So the bits that I did understand quite vividly were the torture bits. Like, my understanding was as well that they told the monk that they could bring his girlfriend back to life, but it turns out that they just, like, drugged her, and then he thinks that he is exercising a demon, but all he's actually doing is killing her. That was my That is what I got from what was happening on screen. And then there's a kind of odd epilogue about the monk then like going around killing women who remind him of Van Houten Annie. What's her name?
Carice Van Houten.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that is basically it. Yeah, novice monk.
That is correct.
Eddie Redmayne. Novice monk. Osmond.
This is the thing. Yeah. You really want a brown belt monk. You don't want a novice monk.
They're all brown
belt. God damn it, dude.
I love the idea of a novice monk. Like, you're not a fully trained monk. Like, you're not... You don't get your full tonsure yet, you know.
You've still got most of your oblates.
You're only allowed to talk quietly.
Yeah, that's a real thing. They're called monastic oblates. They haven't been fully brought in yet. They're usually kids.
You're a fucking monastic oblate.
You hear Eddie over there. He's still chatting. I mean, he's whispering now. But you know, he's not
allowed to manage the herbs unsupervised.
He gets up at like 7 in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I'll say, especially about the epilogue, is I think there were inquisitions in the Middle Ages. There were persecutions in the Middle Ages. There was no ongoing, deeply supported institutional effort to police people constantly. That did not exist in the Middle Ages. And to the extent that it did exist, especially once we get into the 15th and then the 16th centuries, they weren't church-led initiatives. They always depended on secular authority. So the Spanish Inquisition was a secular project. The Roman Inquisition, as it came to exist during the Counter-Reformation, was largely a secular project. Inquisitions in the Middle Ages depended not on religious authority, but on secular authority. You had to have a local lord or someone who's telling you that it's okay to burn these people or throw them wherever. The bishop can't just be like, I'm going to send out some guys to deal with the problem. That's not how religious and political authority worked. It's not how inquisitions worked.
Actually, on that note, there was a bit in this movie where like halfway to the village, they come across this woman who like the people of her village are trying to burn her at the stake as a witch because she was trying to like do some kind of blessing to prevent them from getting the plague. And they're insisting that this is witchcraft. And she's like, no, it isn't. And then I was like, isn't burning people at the stake for being witches a very modern phenomenon?
No, that's also a medieval thing. But the witch hunts are really more of a phenomenon of the 15th and 16th and into the 17th centuries.
Yeah.
The caveat to that is that people, as I mentioned at the very beginning, lost their minds during the Black Death. And they really were casting about, looking for something, anything to blame for this. And I think one of the more interesting books about the Middle Ages that's been written in the past 35 years by this guy, R.I. Moore, who wrote a book called The Formation of a Persecuting Society. And Moore's point is that medieval Christian society, as it develops, is a persecuting society. It becomes one. It isn't one initially. It becomes a persecuting society. And they persecute different outgroups, namely lepers, heretics, and Jews, using much the same set of images, the same language, the same justifications, and the same methods. So the point is less this group is uniquely dangerous than it is these are people that we can identify as outsiders and then persecute them on that basis. So that applies to both larger scale efforts and the more individual ones that happened around the time of the Black Death. So people really were getting dumped in wells, buried alive, drowned, burned, whatever. If there was a case to be made in the deranged reasoning of that particular moment that this person was somehow responsible. So they really were looking for people to blame. That was a real thing. There were pogroms against Jews associated with the Black Death. Any outsider was extraordinarily vulnerable at this particular time. At moments of social stress, that tends to be true. And the Black Death was a moment of the most extreme kind of social stress.
Mm. Well, there you go. I mean, any early Eddie Redmayne film is always weird. Mm. And I feel like this is no... Every role he had before his, like, major Hollywood, like, blockbuster roles, they're all like... I'm like, why is he playing a novice
this
monk?
This is when he was still a novice.
He looks like 12.
This is when he was still a novice Eddie Redmayne. He still had all his hair. It was before...
Yeah, when he was... Well, he's always spoken very quietly, Eddie Redmayne. Pre-Friar. So he made a great monk.
Pre-Friar Eddie Redmayne.
He's sort of like a... He's like Mark Rylance took the substance, you know? He's got that same sort of like quiet muttering boniness.
I kind of associate that with Ben Whishaw.
Yeah, well, similar. You know, Whishaw is like he's much more he's much louder and more brash than Rylance, which is not to say that he's loud or brash at all, but I would say Redmayne has a higher degree of sort of like, well, I just sort of, you know, very quiet.
When we're talking about British actors, this is a very low bar for loudness.
Yeah.
A lot of emphasis on the quiet.
Redmayne has a kind of inside out look to him, I think. Like his mouth looks inside out.
Hmm.
Huh.
This has been Eddie Redmayne Phrenology Corner.
He looks like he's trying to see if he can get all like his lips all over his, like fully over his teeth.
Not where I would have gone with that, but I can see what you're saying.
He looks like he went into like a wind tunnel. Or like he's been shrink wrapped.
Yeah. With that.
That's what happened.
Can you do that sound effect again? Just yeah, that's the one. Yeah,
great.
That's what happened.
The Redmayne wind tunnel where they test Redmayne for his aerodynamic qualities.
Yeah, that's I do love the idea of just sticking Eddie Redmayne in a monk's outfit in a wind
grease
tunnel.
Grease him up, watch him go.
God, those hassocks would really not be an asset in a wind tunnel.
It's aerodynamic. It's to reduce the friction.
Do you think grease is going to help you be more aerodynamic in a wind tunnel? I hadn't thought about that.
I tell you what, there were definitely some monks who were greasing each other up, but I don't think that was the purpose.
If you're a monk and you're wearing your rough-hewn cloak and so on, that's very high friction. That's monkeying with your aerodynamism. So you've got to grease yourself up in order to smooth the fibers of your, you know.
Mm. Look at him, he's greasing himself up like a Festigiato.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the equivalent of like the wet t-shirt calendar for the monks. It's like the hassocks in the wind tunnel, you know, they're all holding him down like Marilyn Monroe.
He's running the monk marathon tomorrow. He's got to go faster than this.
If we weren't all going to hell before this, we are now. I think that it just greased up monks. These are God's chosen servants, man. Yeah.
Greased up monks, new name for the podcast.
Okay, so
you got to go to a back room to get greased up monks.
Oh yeah.
By way
still
of
get it on video.
Hopefully conclusion.
Please.
Jesus Christ. By way of hopefully conclusion, I'm going to give you some anecdotes about medieval monks.
Okay.
So number one is the being a scribe, which was one of the fundamental tasks of a monk, right? Like you got to copy manuscripts down, you got to make sure that the knowledge is passed. We think of that as being like, you know, pretty like high skill job. No, they thought that you made the dumbest boys and you made them scribes. That was just pure manual labor. They didn't actually need to understand what they were writing. They just needed to be able to make the letters look good. Dumb boys, scribes, number one. Number two, they actually were very concerned about monks doing gay stuff or sexually abusing the young monks. That was a repeated concern. There are all sorts of regulations, rules, reminders that are like, you know what, when the little boys come to the monastery, keep a close eye on who's spending time with them. Like that was a concern. They knew enough to be concerned about that. And then also, yes, there were plenty of monks who had relationships with each other. Greased up, I can't speak to that, but that it was a real thing.
Not recorded in the source material.
There is a gap in the historical record.
Yeah, we know far less than we'd like to about the off-brand uses of beef tallow in the Middle Ages. Or is that on brand? I don't know, like, man. I don't know. Is that primary use?
Brother Eddie, we are giving you this beef tallow off-label. So, you know, if you're wary of the side effects.
You know what to do.
I say, Bede, your hog smells of beef tallow. What devilry have you been?
I say, Bede, your hog smells of beef tallow. That's what Mana just said.
What are things the you don't want to hear if you're among the monastery sheep circa 700 AD at Monk Wearmouth Jarrow?
Absolutely not. I think we might as well wrap up the podcast there.
With the idea of Bede greasing his hog.
Tell us one anecdote about medieval monks, and then we can be done.
Runaway monks were a consistent problem. So lots of people who became monks did not actually want to be monks.
Julia Roberts.
They'd been placed there by their parents, they were orphaned. They'd been placed in the monastery with kind of like a gift to see, to compensate the monastery.
Witness protection, so on and so forth.
That's also a thing, is like the third son of you stick the heir, a spare heir of a noble family somewhere in a monastery, like for safekeeping. Right. That's 100%
like
a thing. So there are lots of people.
Henry II's bastard children that gets like made into the Archbishop of York.
You just warehouse them.
It's where they're stashing.
And if you need them, you just bring them out and you're like, not a bastard anymore.
Build like a building society.
Yeah, very much
you
so.
You have to give them a monk's notice. Otherwise you lose the interest.
A monk's notice.
Yeah. Sorry, this Pat. They were constantly concerned about monks running away. And so there are all sorts of rules, regulations, guidelines for how to deal with runaway monks, where you're like, if you see the monk out there, don't approach them. Go find it. It's
they might be armed and dangerous. They might have a greased up hog.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing, is like, because so many people in the Middle Ages were in clerical orders, how to deal with the problem of people who were in clerical orders committing crimes was a consistent one. Where you're like, okay, this guy is technically a priest, but he also raped a woman and stabbed a guy in a bar fight. Whose authority is he subject to? If you want to understand like the legal structure of medieval society, the answer to that question will help you understand it perfectly, because you're like, well, can't just go around murdering people and committing sexual assault. But because he's a priest, does the bishop get to try him, or does the secular authority? And like, really and truly, if you want to understand how, bring in the horse, let the horse choose, or we're going to be greasing up someone's hog. We're just not sure whose. Yeah. So these are like, if you want to understand how the Middle Ages was a different time, it's like, well, that normal looking guy might also unfortunately be a priest. So we don't get to prosecute him for that crime. We're going to have to go find the bishop for it. Like, these are the daily problems of living in the Middle Ages, where you're like, is this guy, whose authority is this guy subject to? How do we make this person responsible for it? Oh, he's the bishop's nephew. He's allowed to do that. Okay. It doesn't really map onto modern categories of analysis particularly well. It's just one of those weird and interesting things about the Middle Ages, is like, they had different rules for how stuff was supposed to work. And you could well encounter a runaway monk. That was a real thing.
But one rule that was consistent is Sean Bean has to die.
He does. Sean Bean has to die.
First of all, that is super interesting. And second, you just have to have like a little bit of sympathy, because you think about how difficult it is to get a bishop at short notice, especially over a weekend. You got to call out an emergency bishop and they're charging Saturday fees.
Yeah, they can only move diagonally. That's a nightmare.
That's excellent. Yeah. Excellent chess
thank
joke.
Thank you. Yeah. Excellent chess joke really is what I was looking to hear today.
I'm here for you, buddy.
Yeah. Thank you. Well,
I think we've pretty well covered this.
That's been the film Black Death. We appreciate you for listening, for being this is a free one, I believe. It is a free one. So if you listen to this, if you want even more of this, why not sign up for the Patreon, where you get twice as much of this? It couldn't be simpler.
The podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Zweimal the podcast. You can sign up. It's $5 a month. US, the ever deflating US.
Fucking hell, man.
US currency. You can... there you'll receive things such as more Sean Bean. We talked about Troy last week, which features Sean Bean, and he doesn't die.
Yeah. As So far as we know, Patreon not currently subject to tariffs, but keep your ears open.
Could happen. And we're going to be doing a new TV series soon, so keep an eye out for that. Lots of things in the pipeline. Until then, we'll see you next week. And also, before we go, I am going to be on tour in Ireland. I'm doing Kilkenny Cat Laughs from the 30th of May to the 1st of June. And then I'm doing tour shows of Sentimental in Dublin, June 2nd, Cork, June 3rd, and Belfast, June 5th. Refugee Action Benefit Show. I'm organising that again. That's going to be in London at the Clapham Grand on the 19th of June. That's got an awesome lineup. Me, Olga, lots of fan favourites, Rajiv, Esther Manito, Jen Brister, really great lineup. If you're in Bristol, I'm doing a show in Bristol, which is like a parody of Question Time. It's an interactive show, but not in a like asking you what your job is and calling you a nonce way. That should be really fun. I'm taping it. I love doing shows in Bristol. Please come. Don't humiliate me. Thank you. Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.